You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
We are this week kicking off a new series. You came on a good week, I hope. We're kicking off a series in the book of Luke called Jesus and the Marginalized. And each week we're gonna spend some time in the book of Luke, look at an encounter that Jesus experienced in the book of Luke. So we're gonna cover a fair bit of ground. This is gonna take us up to Easter. And each week we're going to look at some of the different margins that Jesus met with as he went through his life a couple of thousand years ago. Couple of big things that happened this week that I just want to acknowledge. Does anyone celebrate or recognize Ash Wednesday? Did anyone do anything? Yeah. What did that look like for you, Annalise? Can I ask? Can I give you the microphone so people online can hear?
I feel like Ash Wednesday is something I've always been doing, but for people who haven't been to an Ash Wednesday service, the highlight of the service is when they bring out the ashes, the burnt palm leaves from the previous year's Palm Sunday, and the palm leaves are mixed with holy oil, and then each person in the church receives a blessing with those ashes and oil. You then walk around for the rest of the day with a cross made of ash on your forehead so everyone can see that you have been at the Ash Wednesday service.
Did you wear the ash for the rest of the day?
Most
of the day. That'll do. Yeah. So that's Ash Wednesday. And the purpose of Ash Wednesday is to remind us of our fleetingness, to remind us of ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And so it's quite a somber service. It's a moment of frailty and mortality that they just threw in the church calendar to be like, you're going to die. This year, this happens twice, to sometimes three times every century. It fell on the same day as Valentine's Day. How's that for a collision? There's something quite poetic about that. It meant for a lot of memes, which I appreciated. But there was something quite poetic about that collision of a celebration of life, but also a celebration and recognition of death and mortality, and how that can actually be quite beautiful. So that was a bit of a collision. The other collision, and I sent this out as an email that some of you might have read this afternoon. We were supposed to have Mardi Gras Fair Day. That was supposed to happen today. But why did it get cancelled? Asbestos. As I was thinking today, as I was like, wow, this week has been huge for me, a roller coaster. It felt quite poetic that this week there was ashes to ashes, dust to dust at the same time as this celebration of love. And then Fair Day, there was this dust that just destroyed the fair day. There's something quite poetic about the frailty of life, but also I want to say love wins and celebrate that despite all that, we're still here together. So as we head into this series of Luke, I just wanted to mark that moment to be like, yeah, there's something quite poetic as we kick this off. One of the margins that we're going to explore today a little bit is the experience of refugees. So I'm going to play a video in the moment, and then Pete Easter Wright to come up and do a quick snapshot. Pete works at a place called Starts, and so we're going to hear a bit about what Pete does. Tech team, are we right to do it? We certainly can do Pete first. Yeah? Thrown in the deep end. Come on up. We can use this mic. Pete, welcome. It's good to see you. Oh, yeah, perfect. Pete, how long have you been coming to New City?
Looking to my wife, 2 years? 2.5.
Yeah. And can you tell us, you're about to get a new little member of your family. Who's that?
Oh, you don't know something I don't? Okay. I thought you were thinking Adrian. No. Are you ready? We're about to inherit our third German Shepherd puppy, who's now a month old, and we haven't met yet. We've seen pictures, but next weekend or the weekend after. Yes.
Have you got a name?
Probably Lexi. The previous ones began with L, Lara and Lani. So there's not a lot of names that begin with L. Believe me, it's not that easy.
Yeah. We can come up with a list of 10 by the end of tonight. Scrap the sermon. We're doing it. Okay. Through the week, what do you get up to? Tell us about the agency that you work at.
So I work for an organization called START, or with an organization called START, and I've been there for 5 years. It's my sixth year. START is a very long acronym for the Service for the Treatment and Rehabilitation of Torture and Trauma Survivors. And STARTS has been around for around 35 years now. And we are one of 8 different agencies across Australia that are not-for-profit organisations but are contracted to the government. We're not government, we're an NGO, but we're contracted to the government to provide torture and trauma and rehabilitation services for former refugees. So in New South Wales, that's STARTS. In Queensland, they're called QPAST. In Darwin, it's Melaleuca. In South Australia, etc. So the organisation is kind of split in two halves. Half of what we do is, it's called the clinical services team, which is providing one-on-one intervention in terms of counselling, psychology, psychiatry, and another thing called neurofeedback, but interventions designed at the individual level to help people deal with the very real and significant trauma of their experience as a refugee, particularly if they've suffered trauma in that process. The second half of the organisation is the community services wing, and I work within community services. It's a very big part of the organisation, and my part is very small. But in community services, we're looking at providing that same kind of support and healing, but at a more community level, and particularly working with small groups and whole of community. So breaking it down further, so the program that I lead is called, we have multiple programs, but our basic program is called Families and Cultural Transition, or FICT. And am I going on too long?
That's good.
Okay, so FICT is, I have a team of 6 in Sydney and then 4 or 5 in regional areas of New South Wales who oversee this program. And the program works with different refugee communities to provide support at a group level. So we work generally with a group of 12 to 16 people from the same language group who come together for a period of 10 weeks, meeting together once a week, sharing food together. And we take them through a whole lot of little sort of themes or topic areas. But the idea is to, we use members of the community that we've trained to facilitate this program by cultural facilitators. They lead them through a process of experiential learning. Experiential in the sense that it taps into people's experiences, not focusing so much on their pre-migration journey. We don't dwell too heavily on that, but looking at what's happened since they arrived in Australia and looking at how they're adjusting and trying to help them to support one another to better manage that transition. And the transition for many people is absolutely monumental. They're dealing with all the normal cultural changes that moving from Syria or Iraq or Palestine or Burma, but on top of that, in the midst of their own trauma. So what we're helping people to do is to navigate the changes that are happening in their family, in their relationships, with their physical environment, with economically, with work, and get themselves in a better place to handle that moving forward. Sorry, that's a really long answer.
Every experience of fleeing and finding a new home would have its own contours, and you must hear a huge number of stories. Where in all of that, do you find a sense of hope or the ability to keep going when it would just be, I imagine it would be easy to get overwhelmed by the gravity and the stories that are present. How do you find hope in that? How do other people find hope in that? Is there hope in that? What's the nature of hope, or is it useless asking that question?
If there wasn't, we wouldn't be there. So, for me, the hope comes from, I don't often see the groups on the ground. I'm in that sort of ivory tower role, unfortunately, of supervising and keeping things going. But I get to read the evaluations that we do after every group and every, we have a whole lot of other groups, by the way. We work with older people. We've got domestic and family violence groups. We've got lots of other stuff going on. But I get to read the evaluations that come in from the programs. And what helps keep me going is that I see the change that's happening in people's lives, even after a 10-week intervention. And I get excited by that, and I think, okay, this is why we do what we do. We got to keep going. And then when I hear stories from my clinical colleagues who are working with people, you know, if you normally go to Access Psychology Services through Medicare, they give you 10 sessions, I think it is. Maybe it's five again now. Absolutely hopeless. So we are working with people that come to us without cost, and there's no time limit or limit to the interventions that they have. So sometimes we look through a case of someone who's maybe they've worked with us at a group level, they've worked at a one-on-one level, they've had nutritional help, they've had counselling, they might have had psychology, whatever, but those interventions might go over 2 years. So I've seen people who've had interventions, so they've had 80 counselling sessions. They've had neurofeedback. They've had all sorts of different interventions. But when you look at where they were at when they came to us, and the stories, I'm not going to tell the stories because it's just not right, but the stories are horrendous. But if you look over the incrementally over those 2 years or however long it takes, we see people actually being, when I say healed, I don't mean miraculously, wonderfully, everything's fine, but they're incrementally getting themselves out of some very, very black holes that they were in as a result of what other people have done to them. So at a state level, at a systemic level, and at an interpersonal communal level. So what keeps me going in the role is seeing the effectiveness of what we do. And I also have a fabulous team. It's all women. My entire team, it's unfortunate the boss is a bloke. I can't change that. Well, I'm not going to change that, but it's unfortunate that it is that way. But I've got an awesome team, and a number of them are former refugees. And also when I see what they do and the changes that are happening in their own lives, even that's pretty awesome as well. Yeah.
That's incredible to be a part of and to witness. I know, speaking from experience, it can feel like this is such a mammoth topic, and it feels a bit useless even attempting to make any change. It feels like I kind of, you know, there's nothing I can do. What is it that you say to people? Oh, if you want to make a bit of a change, if you want to do something practical, what can people do?
Move to Southwest Sydney.
Ooh. Yes.
Well, most of the refugees, no, seriously, actually, it's not a bad idea. Yeah. So with an organisation like us, it's not a lot. We have a staff of 250 people in New South Wales, rather large. There is scope to be a volunteer within Starts as an organisation, and we can use people with all sorts of different skills and talents and abilities. If you go onto the website, starts.org.au, you can see how you might do that. For me, it's a matter of whenever you have the opportunity to meet or reach out to someone who's an asylum seeker or a refugee, build bridges. Same with Aboriginal people. Whenever you come into those contexts with people, do what you can to just reach out to that person at the supermarket, at wherever, at work. But thirdly is, please be politically aware, not politically naive. So what's in the media right now? Horror, shock, we've got 40 asylum seekers have arrived by boat, and the sky is falling down politically, you know. So there's this big political battle going on now over these 40, and they're being shipped off to Nauru because out of sight, out of mind. So at a political level, I just would encourage people to be aware of what our government does and has done historically, whoever, whatever your political persuasion, they're just about as bad as each other. Not quite. The current government done some good things, but the punitive sort of regimes that we have in place to punish people and demonize people who seek our protection continues to be abhorrent. So be aware, be politically involved wherever you can. There are marches, there whatever you can do, letter writing, campaigns through Get Up, whoever it is, be engaged. Don't be naive to the realities of what's going on.
Thank you. Let's thank Pete. Thank you for the work that you do. It is absolutely incredible. And as always, you share so much wisdom with us. So yeah, thank you. Look, I think that we might just skip the video and I'm going to send it out as a link, because otherwise we'll just be here all night. You okay, well, let's do it. It's a bit of a long one, like 6 minutes. Forever. Okay, you got this. Brace yourselves. This is from the UNHCR. It is a particularly good video, I think. Came out 2023, about 2022. Gives us a bit of a scope of what's going on in the world. I commend UNHCR's work to you in every front. And as we go through this series, I want us to be a super political church. Thanks for laughing, Chris. I appreciate it. but in all seriousness, I want us to be a church that engages, as Pete said, politically and not be naive. Somebody, actually, I think it was Thomas said, nope, it wasn't Thomas, but you can take the credit for it if you want. Compassion is just love in action. I think you might have said that to me a little while ago, but I've heard that elsewhere. But the idea that in order to be loving, we need to be engaged. And so I hope that we do that well as a community. Okay, can we jump into some Bible? I'm eager. Now that we're here, let's jump into some of the book of Luke. It's a cool book. I'm not going to lie. It's a good one. One of the top 52. It covers a huge part of the New Testament. It's the longest of the Gospels, the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here is a photo of me. That's me in the middle. That's me in my cool rapper days. Did you know I had cool rapper days? No, because I didn't. But that is me at Sydney Missionary Bible College, where I studied theology. I did a Master's of Divinity there, and they absolutely loved me. I'm not gonna lie, I was a golden child of SMBC. By the end of the degree, I was the only one who managed to do Hebrew and my master's. So that was my claim to fame at the day. I haven't used Hebrew since. But it's good to know. I got a tattoo of it just to prove it. But that's me at SMBC. That is going to be relevant a little bit later on. But just enjoy that for right now while you can. I think it's now time to speak about Jesus. Not me, shall we? Jesus in the book of Luke. Annalise, do you want to come up and read for us? We're in the book of Luke. It's going to be on the screen as well. Luke chapter 4. We're going to read from verse 14 through to 30 from Luke chapter 4. But before we do, Annalise, can I announce what you're going to be doing in the next little while?
Yes,
I'm so excited. Annalise has agreed to... We always want to have different people up the front speaking about different topics. And there's a whole bunch of super interesting people in our community. So in the next little while, maybe like once a month or so, we're going to have story time with Annalise. Yeah. Where Annalise is going to interview one of you about what's going on in your world, where you're finding hope, how you're connecting with Jesus, faith, etc. Anyway.
I will be looking for volunteers. So in the next few weeks, if I'm approaching you, asking about your story, that is why.
She doesn't actually care. Luke chapter 4, do you want to read it for us?
Sure.
It's written there as well.
Oh, like brilliant. Yeah.
Luke 4, 14 to 30. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through the whole countryside. He was teaching in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. He began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. "Isn't this Joseph's son?" they said. Jesus said to them, "Surely you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.' And you will tell me, 'Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum.' Truly I tell you," he continued, "no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many windows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a window in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way.
Thanks, Annalise. That's Boss Jesus being Boss Jesus. Jesus and me don't have heaps in common. We're both white males. Stirring the pot. Don't even have that in common. But something that we do have in common is that we've both been cancelled. You! How do we feel about cancel culture? Less excited? I remember this moment when I had come out as gay, and I wasn't dating anyone at that time, but I went back to SNBC because the vice principal had asked me to come back and speak to him. At this time, I was doing some teaching around the place, and he sat me down and he said, "Joel, I just need to let you know you won't be able to lecture here anymore." I said, "I thought that might be the case." And then we kind of both got up and awkwardly walked apart. And that was that. It was the singularly most awkward conversation of my life. He was the vice principal for pastoral care. Whoopsie daisies. In this story, Jesus gets seriously cancelled, and I want to suggest that he got cancelled for the same reason that I did. Thank you for laughing once again, Sammy, but that one felt cruel, didn't it? Jesus got cancelled for the same reason that I did. Because it feels strange, don't you think? Don't you think? There is one moment here where everyone is absolutely praising him. In verse 22, all spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. And then, like, Jesus says two paragraphs, and the next step is everyone in the synagogue is furious. They get up, drive him out of town, they take him to the brow of hill, and they try and throw him off a cliff. Can we just recognize the absurdity of this situation? There is one moment where Jesus is there and everyone is like, "Damn, you're fine. You are good. Like, preach it, brother. We're lapping up what you are saying. Keep talking. Keep going. Spears." It shifts instantly. What did Jesus say that shifted it immensely? Was anyone here mortally horrified by what Jesus said? Nope. Anyone even slightly discomfort? Nope. Okay, so what was going on in this passage that sent them out to kill him? That's the question that we have at this point. Here's what happens. Let me give you the lowdown of what takes place. Jesus says that he has come to, what are the words that he gives us in verse 18? Proclaim good news to the poor. And they're like, yes, we like this. We like this. We want you to proclaim we're poor people. As Israel, where Rome has occupied us for so long, we're poor people, and you've come to give us support. He has been sent to bring freedom to the captive. Yes, I am on board with that. Yes, I am on board, Jesus, with you bringing sight to the blind. Like that is good stuff. That is categorically good stuff. But then Jesus puts his foot on it, in it, when he starts to define who he means by poor and captive and blind. He starts to actually define who he thinks those people are, and he gives two examples from the margins. The first example that he gives is a widow, and a widow in the context of drought, and a widow who is starving with a son. This is from the book of Kings. You can go back and take a look at it. And this widow has just enough food to feed her son for one more day. And Elijah the prophet rocks up and he says, "Can you give me some food?" And the woman says, "I don't have food." And Elijah says, "It's okay. Make some bread with the oil and water that's in your cupboard and you will have food." And so the widow does this. And lo and behold, the next day she wakes up and the stocks have been miraculously refilled. And this miracle goes on for days and days and days, such that the family, the mother and the son, and now Elijah get through the drought together. Good story, isn't it? That's the first story that Jesus tells of the margins. The second one is almost on the polar opposite of that. Naaman is a king's official. He is high up in the empire, he's powerful, but he has leprosy. And so he's been kicked out of many of the social circles, the political circles, but nevertheless, he should have been at the height of his power. He goes up to Elijah, this is also in the book of 2 Kings, he goes up to Elijah and says, "Heal me of my leprosy," and Elijah says, "Go and bathe in the Jordan River seven times." That's the instructions he gets. And Naaman is like, "Surely you could have just healed me. You didn't need to give me some ridiculous instructions about bathing." But nevertheless, the servants say, "No, go do it, try it." He goes, bathes in the Jordan, and he too is miraculously healed. So Jesus says that these are the types of people that he has come to save. Now we read that and then we're like, "Oh, that's really lovely." But the people of the time hear this and they're furious because the woman is not an Israelite. The woman is from Zarephath. She's a Canaanite, the sworn enemies of Israel. Naaman is not an Israelite. He is from Ammon, Syria, who have imposed their might on Israel before. So here's the controversy that breaks out at this point. Jesus says, "I have come to bring freedom and to heal, but the ones who you define as poor, they don't look like you." Everybody cheers because it's such a good message of hope and liberation, but then they pull out their pitchforks when the definition of salvation doesn't look like their definition of salvation. The prisoner who doesn't look like you is also loved by Jesus. That gets awkward. The leper who is on the opposite side to you is also loved by Jesus. The hungry person who voted for the political party that stands polar opposite to you is also loved by Jesus. You see, Jesus' definitions of the poor, the oppressed, the prisoner, they don't fit our boundaries. And remarkably, Jesus died so that death might be defeated, sin might be washed away, so that we can stand in the presence of God for all eternity. Jesus died for that for you, but he also died for those who you really don't want to be in heaven with. So how do you feel about this? How do I feel? This is something I've been wrestling with myself about this week. How do I feel about Jesus dying for people that I feel are repulsive? If I'm honest, I want to throw Jesus off a cliff. Anyone with me? It kind of gets to that point. Old pastoral care vice principal at SMBC. Nah. Jesus died for me. Ugh. It will be really nice to throw Jesus off a cliff, hey? It would solve a lot of problems. Then we can have our people who are saved. We can have our crew that looks like me, that feels like us, that votes the same way that we do, that speaks with the right words, that looks the right way, that engages in society in the correct form. But that is just not how Jesus works. And I have a feeling that if Jesus were to come in here and we were to pin him down and to bind his feet, he would walk out the door. Because he's done it before. So there's the predicament as we kick off our series in the book of Luke. Who is the book of Luke for? Well, it's for you. It's for you in every way. Because Jesus is for you in every way. But it's not just for you. This is far bigger than you. This is far bigger than us. And it expands far more. Let me change tack for a moment. We'll come back to this idea. But I want to change tack for a little bit. And I want to ask a question that we have been asked at our church many, many times, and if you're newish here tonight, welcome to the conversation. Is this church conservative, or is it liberal or progressive? Is it evangelical or ex-evangelical or post-evangelical or anything else evangelical? What is it that this church is? Now, that is a complicated question. Does anyone have an answer? Nope. Everyone's like, oh yeah, good question. What are we? What are we? Now, it would be easy to say we defy labels, because we do. I think that's safe to say. And the person next to you probably disagrees with you on a range of things. And so therefore, it's hard to just stick a label on it and say, this is exactly what we are. But I've found the word. I've discovered what word we are. Yeah, isn't that helpful? Isn't that handy? I've discovered what we are. Well, at least this is what I'm using for myself at the moment. I'm going to invite you to join in that. But I've been thinking more and more about these concepts of conservative versus liberal. Now, they're really unhelpful. So if you're newish to this world, let me give you some grounding. Typically, what we'd say is conservative are the people who hold to historical traditionalist ways of reading the Bible, hold to those really firmly, to the point where nobody else kind of gets a say. That's often how it's framed. And in theological circles, liberals are often framed as the ones who just let the Bible go, and so they don't care about the Bible. Or they might look at, you know, all the historical context of the Bible to the point where it can feel like you've kind of lost the meaning of the Bible a lot. And so that's how it's often framed in these discussions. So here's a question for me. Am I conservative? On a whole bunch of ways, I really am. But here's my definition of conservative that I've been playing with. To be conservative is to hold truths that you love, even if they're not popular. I really like that definition of conservative for me. I sit with that. And to be liberal is to be comfortable and open to change, to explore new ideas. And I really like that word too. So for me, am I conservative or am I liberal? The answer is a hearty yes. That's where I sit. Why do I bring this up at this point as we're starting the book of Luke? Here's why. The book of John, not the book of Luke, the book of John is full of words like, abide in me, says Jesus, abide in me. It's full of metaphors like, I'm the bread of life, I'm the gates of heaven, I'm the path that leads to eternity. These are the types of language that Jesus uses throughout the book of Luke. And in modern days, in evangelical circles, we would phrase those words as having a relationship with Jesus. That's typically how we transfer those metaphors into today. And so if you've followed the whole born again movement, you know, having a conversion moment, there's that. But then there's this idea of having a personal, intimate relationship with Jesus, a relationship that you speak to Jesus and you're present with Jesus. That's the book of John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's just not there. That's not how Jesus speaks, because they were written for different reasons. But Jesus just doesn't talk like that in the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptic gospels. Instead, what happens in Luke is Jesus says, follow me. And then he goes and he starts feeding the poor and healing the sick and speaking to the people on the outcasts. That's what Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. And so as we dive into this book, here's my warning. It will be very easy by the end of this series to have a really long to-do list of things that you're not currently doing, and because you're not doing, the world is a worse place. Does that make sense? It will be really easy to get to the end of this series and just have a heck of a long list of things that you need to get better at. We'll probably do that. Like, sure, like there's things that we can get better at. But if that's all it is, this is a failed series. Because we need John and we need Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We need the vertical relationship with Jesus and we need the horizontal engagement with the world. We need the relationship which typically, evangelical world, conservative world has really nailed. We need that up and down, but then we also need that outward focus, which typically liberal movements have been much better at. We need the conservative, we need the liberal, we need the vertical, we need the horizontal, we need the John, we need the Matthew, Mark, and Luke. To put it in the words of the book of James, faith without works is dead. So we need all of it at the same time. So are we a liberal church? Yes. Are we a progressive church? Damn straight, we better be. But I'm uncomfortable with those words because I think they set up a false dichotomy. Here's my word. You ready for it? Brace yourself. I want to be part of an expansive church. That's the word I'm sitting with at the moment to describe how I approach God and faith. I want to be part of an expansive movement, not in a colonizing way, but in a way that looks at God and says, wow, the more I move further in life, the bigger I discover that you are. I want it to be so that in 10 years' time, I look back at 2024 Joel and I think, wow, your picture of God, that was cute. Because in 10 years' time, I have discovered so much more about God. In 10 years' time, I have discovered that Jesus is so much grander than I had known. And as time moves on, our picture of God is expanding and growing and growing. I want to be a part of a community that is expansive, that has boundaries. It's very hard to erase boundaries, but has boundaries that just keep getting bigger and bigger as we discover more people that need a home that they can just land in. I want to be part of a community that builds a bigger table every time that we discover that there's somebody new in our midst. I want to be part of a church that when Sydney looks at it, they say, I'm glad that church exists. You don't hear that about many churches. But I think if we were to be an expansive church that looked at the love of Jesus and said, there is space here, that would be really beautiful. Here's the biggest problem that I can see, and maybe you can see problems with this word, but here's the biggest problem that I can see. People don't like expansive. People like small. People don't like things that they can't understand. People like boxes. And so when Jesus started to say, it's not just you that I have come to be part of, Jesus said, it's everybody. At that point, let's find the nearest cliff. Because Jesus was so unbelievably expansive. He got cancelled. Ironically, when I started to say, I think there is room in God's love for me as a gay man, same thing happened. As soon as we start saying, actually, no, there is love here that is big, it's risky. It's a dangerous way of being. And so there's going to be pushback. So then, as we drive on through the book of Luke, how do we do this without becoming utterly exhausted? How do we do this in a way that doesn't wear us down? I'm going to get to that in just a moment. But before we do, I want to offer two things that are coming up. Two things that I can put on your to-do list, which if you don't do, the world will be a worse place. You ready? First one is Feast for Freedom. Oh, maybe it's not going to work. It's here, but it's not there. Mariah, you might be able to see Feast for Freedom in my slides. The Asylum Seeker Resource Center runs this every year, and I'm proposing that it would be cool for us to get on it again. We've done it in the past, and it's a really cool activity. Refugees and asylum seekers gift a bunch of recipes, and then we get together and hold a couple of meals and cook those recipes together. And if you can chip in 10, 20, 30 bucks, all of that money goes to the Asylum Seeker Resource Center. If we can get, I reckon, three people who put up their hand to say, yep, I'm happy to host a meal for our community, then we'll get people to sign up and say, like, head to this person's house and we'll divvy it up. So if anyone wants to host a feast, let me know, because that would be absolutely wonderful to do. The second one is the next slide, Mariah. And that is the Pilgrimage for Gaza. And I want to commend this to you. This is starting to happen. You may have seen it on socials starting to kick off. It's where people are walking the length of Gaza and using it as a chance for prayer throughout the series of Lent that we're in at the moment. Well, there's two things that I want to commend to you as we go into this series. What I want to do, and I don't know if this will actually work, but each week I want us to look at a different type of margin and how that interacts with the people that Jesus is interacting with. And I hope it's going to be encouraging for us. I hope it's a time together where we can really ground ourselves in who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. I know that Beck is going to bring one of the sermons. Woo! And Beth is also prepping one. We've got some good stuff coming up. If you want to chat to Annalise because you want to tell a story, or if you see Annalise walking towards you, don't run. Engage in conversation. She's absolutely lovely. Hey, do we have any thoughts before? Oh, I have a couple of announcements. Does anyone want to offer any thoughts on what we've just covered? This concept of expansive, justice, Jesus, any wisdom? It may be bubbling, but hasn't yet formed words, which thankfully we have a chance to discuss at the pub in just a moment. After this, we'll pack up and then we'll all go to the pub together. And I invite you to use that as a time to keep getting to know one another, keep these conversations going.